Danielle Rose and her song Reason to Believe. We heard from Bart Miller to Have a Little Talk with Jesus, and from Barry McGuire, an old favorite, a classic from the olden days, Happy Road. 12 minutes past the hour. Don Clark joins us. Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he hangs out down in Garden Valley, Texas, among the grapes down there. And Don, you tell me you've had a few late nights there harvesting grapes, have you?
Oh, very long days. harvesting. Our one field, we had quite a lot of grapes, and so we started on Friday, and we just finished up yesterday. Oh. I just finished up last night with cleaning the equipment up and everything.
There's so many grapes and so little time.
Yep, but we pretty much work constantly. From early morning until late in the afternoon.
Okay, so. Let me see your hands. I want to see if they're stained purple here. No, appear not to be.
Nope.
Okay, all right. Okay,
we're good on the hands.
Already,
not so good on the body. It was a lot of hard work.
Is there a sense of urgency? I mean, is it like the grapes now all the field is at its peak and it needs to be picked right now? So you got to just rush through it. I mean, is there some urgency to that?
Yes. Once the grapes become ripe, they only get... a couple of things happen. All the critters find out that you've got ripe grapes.
There's some urgency.
They start to visit. So the last couple of rows in this particular vineyard had... somebody was getting in there. Probably raccoons and birds and deer trying to get the grapes.
You had wild pigs down there too, didn't you? Feral pigs?
Yeah, well, fortunately, this vineyard's high enough that the trellis is high enough that the pigs can't get to it. But we do have pigs. We put up a nice field fence around about 2 1/4 size of our property, and it kept the pigs out for a while. But the deer just jumped over the fence. It was an 8-foot fence.
Wow, an eight foot fence.
Jump over it.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's supposed to keep out the deer, but I guess they had a running start because the property behind us in that area is sloped, sloped downward towards our fence. So I don't know. Anyway, it's always a struggle, but we had a good harvest. We had over 2 tons. Worth of grapes, produced over 300 gallons of juice.
Okay. So, and this will be turned into what kind of wine?
It's Blanc du Bois, and so it's a white wine, and it's the wine that a couple of years ago, this year actually I won the gold medal on it, but the wine from 2 years ago was the wine that we won a gold medal. So... it should be. We're looking forward to another good wine out of this.
Okay.
We picked it a little late, so I have to run the chemistry on it in the next couple of days.
Your biochemistry will come in handy then, and you'll have your white lab coat on and your test tubes and your Bunsen burners going, and you'll test this grape.
Do you know how sweet it is? Is it higher than normal?
Well, it was higher than 2013. The Brix on 2013 was only 17, which kind of translates to 17% sugar, which was low. This one should be starting off 19. It might be, higher than that. But typically, Blanc de Bois, you want to pick it before it's completely ripe because you want the acid, in your wine. It's more important to have the acid than the sugar. You can always adjust the sugar, but you can't. Okay. It's more difficult to adjust the acid.
This is really a technical business, isn't it? I mean, you can make fine measurements and make adjustments. Yeah, I could see you in your laboratory and your boiling cauldron and your all that stuff.
It is a lot of chemistry. It is a lot of testing. You got to add sulfite. You got to keep sulfite levels just right. Too high, if you start your fermentation, you can kill your bacteria. I mean, your yeast by having too much sulfite in there. If it's not high enough, then you start having oxidation and competition from other microbes. So you know, the pH has to be just right. The total acidity has to be right. Of course, the sugar content determines how much alcohol you can potentially produce, you know, in the wine.
Okay.
So the lower the sugar, the lower percentage.
As long as it has a good head on it, that's all I'm concerned about here.
A good head.
Yeah.
This is not beer. We are not making beer.
Oh, okay.
Now listen, there's a mystery here we need to solve this morning, and this is an article from the Institute of Creation Research, and it purports to solve the missing tropical dinosaurs mystery. Article by Dr. Tim Clary. And this is interesting. I didn't realize there were no dinosaurs in the tropics. Did you know that before, Don?
There were dinosaurs there.
Oh, okay.
But it's just that they didn't happen to die there.
Oh, I mean, okay.
That's the mystery. I mean, why? So because they don't find any fossils in this particular area, they assumed that they weren't there, at least the big ones.
Yeah. So the big ones were, what, farther north?
Well, they traveled farther north. They purport this particular article, or this particular researcher, Jessica Whiteside of the University of Southampton in the UK, and her colleagues purport that, well, since we don't find any large dinosaurs, we find some smaller ones, but we don't find any large dinosaurs in this particular area, Triassic area in North America. We think, therefore, and there's a lot of increases and decreases in carbon dioxide in the rocks. So you take their various levels, and you can measure how much carbon dioxide is there, and from that you can make a huge assumption and say, hey, the climate was changing, and it's because of this great rapidity of fluctuation in the climate, that is hot weather and cooler weather and hotter weather and cooler weather, that it drove off the bigger dinosaurs, and they couldn't, it wasn't a conducive environment for them.
I guess they can't blame that on us, can they?
No, they can't. So, but it was they tried. They're trying to blame this on climate change.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you mean they can take the rocks and measure the CO2 levels in the rock?
Yes.
So that they think that is the whatever exists within the rock in terms of gases was typical of the atmosphere back when the rock was formed.
Right.
Oh, is that accurate?
Well. Yeah, I don't know how accurate it is. I mean, you know, I don't work in this area, so I can't tell you exactly how accurate it is.
I'm just reading a paragraph. It says the high frequency fluctuations in CO2 found in the rocks are not necessarily indicative of ancient atmospheric conditions. The CO2 in question is not an ancient air sample, and even if there were some type of atmospheric fluctuation, these conditions would have been worldwide, not just affecting the tropics, which is kind of an interesting finding here. And it serves to refute her claims. It says that's not reliable.
Yeah, of course it's not. It's not reliable. So, but you know, you try to hang on to whatever little bit of information that you can when you don't have an alternative explanation for what happened to the larger dinosaurs. There was absolutely no reason for the larger dinosaurs not to be there. Of course, but this has been a puzzle for those who believe in evolution and long age, you know, for the Earth and for the universe. So this, you know, why weren't the dinosaurs there? And so they're trying to come up with an explanation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this gal and her team thinks that they have an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is there a better explanation for why the dinosaurs weren't there? And so, is there? This is the question.
Good question, yeah.
So, since it is this area that they're talking about is kind of an interior of the United States, the southern New Mexico you know, into New Mexico and that
there's an interesting map as part of this article, by the way, which we'll link to in the podcast that we'll post a little bit later this morning. I guess this has to do with the thickness of rock layers, and that relates to the number of fossils found. And there's something called the Dinosaur Peninsula that goes diagonally from the Great Lakes region down to, what is that down there? That's Arizona and New Mexico.
They call it
the Dinosaur Peninsula. Now, we know that some fossils are found down there. A lot of them in Montana, a lot of them north in Canada, but I know Colorado has been famous for its fossil finds, and so has Wyoming, and presumably New Mexico. I don't know that for a fact, though.
Well, the New Mexico, the area where they were looking, of course, only has the small dinosaurs.
Mm.
And the larger dinosaurs you don't find until you get further north. Now, the interesting thing about this map, of course, it's kind of a sediment layer map,
mm-hmm.
and it tells the story as to what happened, really, because we're going to talk about the global flood again,
mm-hmm.
because this is the answer is in the the global flood. So we know that the flood was global, but it did take a little bit of time for the water to start encroaching, especially further inland. Since this is a map of the United States, a lot of things were happening at the time of the global flood. We talked about plate tectonics in the continents, the Pangaea breaking up into multiple continents, the seven continents that we have today. And as that broke up, of course, we had various episodes, if you will, of volcanic activity, and a lot of volcanic activity, and that would correspond with spurts, for example, of CO2 being thrown up into the atmosphere at various times, and there would be dust over the around the world.
This is over the course of some 700 years or so, right, from the time of the onset.
Flood, mm-hmm. to the ice age and post ice age, that whole time was probably 500 to 700 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and even that's kind of a guess, but we're not talking about millions and millions of years. We're talking about hundreds of years. But what was happening, let's say, on the interior of the United States? Well, you would expect, obviously, that the coastal regions of the United States would be flooded first. And as you moved inward, that as the waters began to rise, that the interior of the United States would be, and other continents as well, would be an area that would be drier for a longer period of time. So let's assume, for example, that the animals were on the coastal regions, they began to move inward as this calamity or this catastrophe began to happen, and until they got to, on this map, which is called Dinosaur Peninsula, until they got to the higher points, within the United States, for example. And of course, it wasn't the United States at that time.
And again, to envision this peninsula, I'm looking at the map here, and it's a diagonal stretch of territory through the center of what is now the United States, going from the Great Lakes diagonally down toward the southwest, ending up around New Mexico. And so you're saying that especially the larger dinosaurs who could travel over that time were able to basically come inland from the flooded coastal areas, correct?
Well, correct. And mm-hmm. and then as from the south, as the waters began to encroach further northward.
Mm-hmm.
The smaller dinosaurs, they couldn't run as fast, they couldn't, walk as fast, so they couldn't avoid the flood that was encroaching, the waters that were encroaching upon the land, and so they would get trapped get trapped in the sediments that were being formed by this horrific, catastrophic encroachment of water. Whereas the larger dinosaurs, as you kind of just mentioned, would be able to travel. They would travel, you know, further north until eventually the waters got so deep and the violence, you know, was so so strong that it would even entrap them. And, you know, there are areas, for example, where you can find dinosaur tracks in the rock, which, of course, is sedimentary rock, as evidence of, you know, these creatures traveling. And then eventually, you know, find the skeletons and the bones, and the further north you get, it's almost like they're all, you know, mixed up and tangled as if a giant tsunami came and washed them away and kind of washed them to a certain, you know, a given area.
And that's easy to envision as you look at this map. You can just envision over the course of 500 to 700 years, basically the coasts, east and west, on the continental, you know, northern American continent here, creeping in and forcing wildlife of all kinds in toward the center, that those that could escape and could move, and hence the concentration, especially of large dinosaurs, in places like Montana and southern Canada. It makes great good sense.
That to me seems like a much more plausible explanation as to why you don't have have the larger dinosaurs in the tropical areas. Obviously, the dinosaurs need the bigger the animal, the more food it's going to take. Like with the elephants and other large creatures. So they're going to want a more tropical area than an arid area. And before the flood, food for the animals was not a problem, because the after God created the earth and put Adam in the garden, and then eventually made Eve out of Adam. It says that God says that everything was perfect. Which meant that the atmosphere was perfect, the plants were perfect, the humans were perfect, the animals were perfect, everything was perfect. So you had plenty of vegetation. And the only thing that disrupted that vegetational growth was this gigantic worldwide catastrophe called the global flood. And, after the flood, the earth was not perfect anymore. And it took a while, obviously, for the vegetation to return. And so all of the animals, all the land animals, perished as a result of the flood. And it was only after, when Noah actually opened, the door to the ark was opened, and Noah and his family came out, and of course all the animals came out, that the animals began to populate the earth again.
Another interesting idea that you've talked about from time to time is the climate on the earth pre-flood. You've described as being uniform, which suggests that life forms would have been uniform north to south, not like we see them today.
Right, and you know how much variation in temperatures there would be between, you know, now again, you know, we're talking about one large continent as opposed to several different types of continents spread out across the globe.
Talking about Pangaea, then pre-flood, it was one landmass on the Earth, and even secular scientists pretty well agree to that, don't they?
Yes, they do, and so. What exactly, you know, how, what was the atmosphere like? What was the climate? It was, probably more temperate, much more temperate than we have today. We didn't have even Greenland and Iceland and the polar caps weren't even there because they were all part of this, this Pangaea. And so I'm sure there was some, because there was some variation in climate as you go from north to south, but it had to be fairly temperate, and it had to be very, very conducive, for life. and not only plant life, but for animal life. And so animals lived a long time. Humans lived a long time. You know, we have at least historical records, you know, in the Bible that humans lived 900 plus years, mm-hmm. unless you were taken by God, as Enoch was. And he was quite a friend of God, and Enoch didn't die. So you had those rare events, but for most humans at the time, pre-flood, they were living, you know, 900 plus years.
Now, an interesting assumption in this article is that these dinosaurs lived where they died and where they were found. That's not necessarily the case, is it?
Well, of course not. Animals can move. And as we know today, animals can sense a danger. And it's quite evident because animals move from the coast when they sense a tsunami coming. And that's exactly what we were having. Mm-hmm. You know, all across the globe, these huge tsunamis were taking place. So they can sense danger, and they begin their migration away from the danger zones.
Now, one of the things I'm suggesting here, though, is that even after they've died and been fossilized, that fossil can end up in some other location, not necessarily where the death occurred.
Well, of course it can, mm-hmm. and especially if it's carried by water. We know that water mm-hmm. can carry things for not only miles, but, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of miles. And it depends on, the velocity of water and how fast it's going before mm-hmm. whatever it is that it's carrying, in this case, a bunch of animals, finally slows down enough that they could be deposited.
Well, one of the interesting finds here was that by measuring the CO2 and doing other studies of the rocks in New Mexico, they've determined that at the time that the Triassic period, I guess it is, that those rocks were actually located in tropical climates. In other words, they had moved north, which suggests, again, the movement of the continents and maybe the breaking up of Pangaea.
Yes, and a lot of the rock layers that we see today, of course, was deposited at the time of the flood. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, what can you say? What can you say about that particular region before this catastrophe? Mm-hmm. I mean, the surface of the Earth was completely reformed. Of course, you didn't have the mountain ranges that we have today. You didn't have the Sierra Nevadas. You didn't have, the Rocky Mountains. You didn't have any of that. It was, yes, there were hills, and some of them were probably fairly high. But, we know for Genesis, for example, that the water covered all of the Earth. And, yes, there's enough water on this earth to cover all of the earth, especially when you understand that giant valleys were formed in the ocean, for example. They're now in the ocean. And because of the difference in density between, different layers of earth, then the earth was uplifted in certain areas, in this case the Rockies for the central part of the United States. And so you had a complete transformation of Earth. So what can you say before this, what can you say about the antediluvian, period before the flood? I mean, from a geological point of view, you can't say anything. Mm-hmm. You can't say anything about what the surface of the earth was like, before the flood, unless you have an historical record. And, of course, we do have historical records. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have the Bible, and there's other extra biblical materials that can give us an idea, at least from man's perspective, as to what things were like.
Well, so you can either be guided by what you read in the Bible, and in particular Genesis, and its account of not only the creation but the flood, or you can construct a theory and project it backwards and call it evolution.
Well, right. I mean, especially if you if your geology is coming from long age type of geology. instead of catastrophic geology.
The underlying assumption of an old Earth is necessary before evolution can take form as a theory.
Yes, and Charles Lyell was the European, for example, who proposed that the geology that we see is the result of long age.
Mm-hmm.
And it was him who greatly influenced Darwin, for example. Mm-hmm. Darwin wasn't the first one to think about that, and wasn't even the first one to think about perhaps, you know, evolution. But Darwin happened to solidify it and write a big book about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Charles Lyell, the geologist, who said the geology that we see is from long age.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had it completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Creationist geologist and creationist scientists, understand from the Bible that we had a global catastrophe, and this global catastrophe formed the geology that we see today. And when you begin to look at, you can go to the central parts of the United States, you can head west, and go across the country, you find evidence for flooding all over the country. It's just once you get out of the woods and the grassy, you know, areas, for example, of the east, and you start heading west, you hit Montana and North and South Dakota, and you got the Black Hills, and I mean it's all mm-hmm. Flood related. Geology is quite evident. It certainly depends on, you know, your starting point and your assumptions as to how you begin to interpret the data that you're finding.
You know, I've got a question comes to mind here. Is there a middle ground? You know, we constantly talk about old Earth and young Earth, and creationism and evolution. Is there any scientific thought that lies in the middle? Or are we necessarily in these two opposite poles, these two camps that can't seem to convince the other, even though the evidence they're looking at is the same evidence? I mean, is there somebody that said, no, we're in between someplace? Is there such a thing as a scientific compromise?
Well, from a biology point of view, I don't think there is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God did create, the man and, of course, the animals and the vegetation to have variations on the kind. So that's why you got different types of apples and, mm-hmm. Different types of oranges. And even, we've helped things along agriculturally by selective, breeding, for example. And the great evidence of that is the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But variations within a kind does not, make a whole new species for, not species, but a whole different kind. Is there room for the two camps to say, hey, maybe you've got an interesting point, and the other side's saying, well, you got an interesting point, and maybe the truth lies in the middle. God is very clear that he created man, he created the animals to breed, if you will, to reproduce after their own kind. It was not this haphazard, random process that evolution describes, but a very directed process.
Mm-hmm.
God spoke it and it came into existence. We don't know the exact details how he did that, but we know that the things that we see around us, especially in the biological realm, are a result of intelligent design,
mm-hmm.
are a result of a creator, and not this random process where you try to eliminate the creator and you replace it with Mother Earth, who created all things.
Mm-hmm.
an inanimate, you know, object at best.
That's an odd assumption to me. I can see here where there are theological compromises. Deism, for example, a God who created and then turned his back on the universe and has nothing further to do with it. But in science, apparently there is no room for it. There's room for discussion and trading of information and analysis and reanalysis, but not compromise in the world of science. I mean, you're looking for a fact or a set of facts.
Well, and you, once you find the facts, or you think you find the facts, then you apply different guesses, if you will, mm-hmm. to those facts and say, theories. Well, how did those facts get there? And that's what these folks are trying to do. I mean, from the University of Southampton, they're trying to trying to come up with a reasonable explanation. It just so happens that their assumptions are wrong, and there is a better explanation for what they're finding.
Interesting article: Solving the Missing Tropical Dinosaurs Mystery by Dr. Tim Clary. And the article is over at the Institute of Creation Research, and we will provide a link to that article in our podcast of our conversation with Dr. Don a little later this morning here. You'll find it at Broken Road Radio. If you go to the top of our homepage, you'll see a tab that says podcasts. And you click on that and you go down to Dr. Don's name, and then you'll see a chronological ordering of all the podcasts we've had with Dr. Don for the past, 4 years now. And there's quite a library of interesting young earth creationist information there and thought. And I invite you to peruse those, sample them. I also invite you to check out their website, Creation Moments. CreationMoments.com is the website. You can link to them from ours. It's one of those icons, those links over to the right-hand side of our homepage, Creation Moments. There you will find just a wealth of information, scientific writings and videos and blogs and commentaries on young earth creationism. And I would invite you to maybe not even take one side or the other until you've seen both sides. And see what you think. Do your own evaluation of that science, and then draw your conclusions. And Don, that's one reason we're so grateful for your presence here. You're a voice crying in the wilderness, I think, sometimes.
Well, there's others like me around.
Yeah.
And some folks have a larger voice than mine. But we all just try to glorify God in what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Just like Mark Armitage with his soft tissue and dinosaurs trying to speak about the truth.
By the way, there are podcasts with Mark present in our broadcast, our conversations on that podcast archive too. So, but Don, you bring a level of reasonability and calm, collected approach to this that you don't always get to hear in the middle of this argument. And so I think you're a real prize. We're grateful for your time, and we thank you.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure to do these programs.
Dave, any last minute questions? I hate to start the music and move on without having heard from you.
Well, most of the program, I was scrambling with computer issues.
No.
I'd gotten one of those annoying little things that you click on it to make it go away and it won't go away. So I had to go around the back door and get rid of it. And, okay. It was pretending to be somebody from Microsoft, and it wasn't. Do you find I guess I'm one of those anomalies called an old guy optimist. And every once in a while I see something positive and something encouraging, and it's easy to, being a wild-eyed optimist like me, it's easy to extrapolate that into some sort of a movement. But do you ever see glimmers of positive results, glimmers of hope, glimmers of, maybe some of these scientists saying, well, maybe all the things that I've been taught and believed and swallowed whole cloth for since I was a beerless undergrad, maybe they are kind of caca. Do you ever, or maybe more people taking the side of a young earth creationist, or looking at some of the dominant dogma of the left and the evolutionists? Do you ever get those glimmers?
Well, of course, there are many scientists who have changed their mind. And who once it's pointed out to them the illogical nature of their particular position, And if they, you know, if they have an open mind and, you know, if God is present, then their mind, you know, they do change their mind. And some very famous scientists have done just that.
You're one of them.
Oh yes, I am one of them. I am, because I was an ardent evolutionist at one time, and my eyes were open after I accepted the Lord, just purely by faith. You know, it wasn't because of any logic at that particular time, but of course, post salvation and post accepting the Lord, my eyes were definitely open, and it became obvious that creation was the way the creation as described in the Bible was the way that all of this came together.
Well, in those moments, did the evidence was the same. The information that you were looking at was the same, but you viewed it from a different perspective?
Well, yes, you do view it from a different perspective, because you are... the basic assumption is that you don't want a creator. I mean, you don't think this is at the time, but you don't want to know that there is a loving God out there. You don't want to know that there's a God out there, first of all, and that you're accountable. And so it's easy for you to come up with a rationale as to how we got here. And, you know, the evolutionary story, without seriously looking at the evidence, is a believable story, obviously, because 50% of our population believes the evolutionary story. But obviously, through the Holy Spirit, you know, working within me, I mean, it was like, okay, one day I believed, and then I was saved, and then the next day it was, hey, that's all wrong. Literally, my eyes were opened.
It wasn't
a process that took a long time. It was like, here's a book. Why don't you read this? And it happened to be Henry Morris's Genesis Record. I began reading that. It was a commentary on Genesis, obviously. The first section of that is all about the flood and all about what life was like and, pre-flood. And it's like, yeah, this makes perfect sense. Matter of fact, it makes more sense than the evolutionary
story. It's like all of a sudden all those things that were separated by questions and doubts fell into place.
Well, yes, and you know, before this time, it was like you didn't really think about it. You know, you just had the evolution. I had the evolutionary story down, and that was my story. I mean, it wasn't my story, but you know, I picked up on the story that had been passed down. And it's definitely in the schools and the universities, and so that's the story that you went with, because that was the scientific story. And this is the facts that and this is how it happened. When you actually see it from God's perspective, and you you have the Holy Spirit working within you, it's like, hey, you know, that's all wrong.
Now the light goes on.
Yeah, I guess we get involved in the notion that we can somehow whip the scales off of these people's faces or eyes rather, and allow them, or at least with the force of our logic and our arguments, you know, they will just be kind of cuddled into believing that they're actually seeing things for the way they are accurately. But all our ranting and raving and getting red in the face is kind of useless activity, because they're doing the same thing and they're going to resist that.
Well, of course, that's why we feature somebody like Dr. Don here, just to make a reasonable presentation of this thing.
Yeah, the best course is to ask the Holy Spirit to do his work.
Amen. Don is a biochemist and a member of the board of creationmoments.com. Don Clark, we thank you very much, and we'll let you go back to your grape picking. You probably got more to do, huh?
Well, I got some setting up to do, and I got to work with the juice that I pressed over the last 4 days.
You got your hands full. Don, take care. We'll see you next week, okay?
Okay, very good. Bye-bye. So long, folks.
So long, Don.